things about Wisconsin.
Yes.
I'll get every knot out of here.
Oh, very. This is an interview with Henry Lardy on May 6, 1983. We're talking in his office, and I'm Laura Smale. So will you describe the what the influences were that led you into science, biochemistry?
When I was in high school, the most challenging job that I knew about was to be a high school teacher. So I went to the university, to South Dakota State College, as it was called at that time, with the intention of becoming an agricultural teacher in high school. And soon after I arrived, I found a job in the dairy department feeding experimental animals, which I held for 2 years. And then while taking a quantitative chemistry course, the instructor told me to go downstairs to visit the professor who was in charge of the chemistry department experiment station. And apparently he was the person who directed interested chemistry students to the experiment station to work as juniors and seniors. So the last 2 years of my college career were spent in the station working for Professor Moxon on selenium toxicity, and as a result I published two or three papers with Professor Moxon as an undergraduate. Only one of these was in a prestigious journal, the Journal of Biological Chemistry. The others were in the Proceedings of the South Dakota Academy of Science. At that time, South Dakota State was one of the major sources of graduate students for the University of Wisconsin Department of Biochemistry.
That's very clear.
And when I was a junior, Professor Moxon brought a carload, and that was about six, I think, students. And all six of us, including our professor, came here to be graduate students. Moxon had a master's degree at that time and came here and finished his PhD in the biochemistry department.
What accounts for that? It's extraordinary.
The fact that there was an experiment station laboratory directed by a very vigorous person whose name was...
Well, you and Van Potter, we'll remember.
Oh. You better shut off your... The head of that laboratory was Dr. Kurt Walter Franke, who did much of the original work on selenium toxicity. And not only did he do good research, but he was also innovative in developing experimental techniques. He was the man, for example, who developed the battery cage for rats. Prior to Franke, every laboratory had shelves along its walls with little round cages, and rats were housed individually, and it took a great deal of time and care to feed and clean these cages. The battery cage improved nutritional research tremendously. Mm-hmm. He also invented a number of other gadgets, including food conserving dishes, the conical feed cups for rats. He encouraged his students to do research in the laboratory and to go on to graduate study, and he sent students both to the University of Minnesota and to Wisconsin. Among the Wisconsinians are Potter and Burris and Hutton and Ryan and Dick Potter, Van's cousin, Orville Bentley, who's now an assistant secretary of agriculture, dean of agriculture at Illinois and also at South Dakota, Ken Dubois, who got his degree with Van Potter, Arnold Schaefer, Kurt Jensen, who received only a master's degree, but I think he had something like 10 to 15 papers in the 2 years that he was here working with Professor Phillips, and so on. Several others whose names slipped me at the moment. At any rate, when I was a senior, I heard from one of the graduate students who was here at Wisconsin, Harlan Anderson, that there was an opening in reproductive biochemistry with Professor Phillips, and I sent my qualifications and was accepted. So I came here in June of 1939.
What do you mean by an opening? I mean, wouldn't they take any number of graduate students?
No.
Or did he mean a fellowship?
An opening consisted of a laboratory space available and financial support for the individual. Mm-hmm. I think I got $60 a month when I came, and...
Was that a war fellowship, do you know?
No, it was money provided by the College of Agriculture and specifically earmarked to do something about artificial insemination. At that time, artificial insemination was sort of pie in the sky. It was something that the Russians were working on, but there was no possibility of carrying out this on a practical basis because semen couldn't be stored and retain its fertility for more than a matter of hours. And the people in the dairy industry were very interested in the possibility of improving livestock by being able to use very important productive bulls for breeding more than the limited number of cows that could be served under natural fertilization conditions. I came then in June of 1939, and by September we had solved the problem for practical storage of semen for artificial insemination, and immediately the cooperative breeding programs developed. I think some half dozen co-ops in the state of Wisconsin started up, and they were very successful. It has now become an almost universal practice in some countries. I understand that in Denmark it is illegal for a farmer to own a bull. In Russia, at least 95% to 98% of all the sheep as well as the cattle are artificially inseminated. And in Israel, this is also true. A very high percentage, almost all of the cattle are artificially inseminated. That solution of the practical problem...
Had Phillips been working on that himself?
He just started on it, apparently, briefly before I came. Mm-hmm. And he was a person of practical bent and decided that we should work with things that would be available to the farmer. So in attempting to prepare a suitable medium for storing the semen, he urged me to use all kinds of things that would be indigenous to the farm, and this included milk and skim milk and
eggs
and
egg
so on. And I don't recall what all we did use, and finally it turned out that buffered egg yolk was the ideal medium.
And this, you hit on this, as I gather.
Very early in the period that I was here, within a month, I think we had good luck in storing semen.
What sort of a person was Phillips? He doesn't figure much in people's accounts.
I wouldn't call him a scholar. He grew up in Washington State on a big farm, a wheat farm. A very tough individual physically. He wasn't very large, but in his youth he drove 29 horses on a combine, and to keep them all going at an equal pace, he had a box full of stones and kept throwing them, and he credited that experience with developing his baseball arm. He was a very good baseball catcher. In fact, his hands were all beat up. I don't think he had a finger or a thumb on either of his hands that were intact, because they'd all been broken at one time or another playing baseball. He was a nutritional scientist, got his degree with Hart. I must confess that he never inspired us very much in a scientific way. He never came in with dramatic insights to some metabolic process. But he did give his students a great deal of freedom, and in some way or other he inspired us. And I don't think there's any professor in the biochemistry department who ever had such a high success ratio. He has more deans and departmental chairmen among his students, and he's got college presidents among them. And apparently, in some way or other, he encouraged people to develop individually. And they all turned, or the vast majority of them turned out to be successful in their careers.
It's, I wonder, at the time you must have been aware of Steenbach and Link as being outstanding scientists in Alvian. You were put with Phillips because there was this vacancy there.
Yes.
Did you envy their graduate students at all?
No, I was very pleased to be working with Phillips because we did have a great deal of freedom and could develop our research.
And you were aware of
this, I think, right? I might have been lost if I had not had the research experience at South Dakota. Mm. But by having that experience, I was able to come here and begin doing useful work immediately. Now, if you promise to bury this thing until most people are dead,
all right.
I must tell you something about some of the giants.
Mm.
I was very disappointed in Steenbach. I don't think he was a great scientist. He did a marvelous thing in discovering the radiation of foodstuffs to develop vitamin D, but thereafter there was nothing that he contributed to any students in coursework. I was terribly disappointed in Carl Link. Learned very little from him in classes. He was immensely entertaining, but he didn't impart any great deal of scientific knowledge. Now, he may have done so with the students in his own laboratory,
mm.
but in the classroom, he gave us routine information about carbohydrates that would have been available in any textbook, and he wasn't an inspiring teacher. A very dramatic lecturer in public lectures, a great dissipator of time in classrooms because he'd get on to some ridiculous subject and harp on it for a long time. Absolutely no knowledge of nutrition. He would try to foist ideas on the students that were completely wrong.
Oh, goodness.
I think most people were aware of that. I had a vicious argument with him once about well, it was in the class. He gave us a question on an exam, and he listed about six compounds and asked which of those could be used as a sole, would be best used by people if that were their sole food for survival under some circumstances. The answer he wanted, of course, was D-glucose, because that was his favorite compound to work with. And I put down cytochrome C as the substance that would be the best food. And of course he challenged me on that, and I pointed out that it was the only protein that was in the list of six, and you could very easily make glucose out of cytochrome C, but you couldn't synthesize your own proteins out of glucose. So we had a vicious argument. I don't think he ever held it against me or anything, but he did have peculiar ideas on, that he tried to impose on students.
You use the term vicious. One can have serious articles.
Well, perhaps vicious. Serious, yes. I mean, there were strong words exchanged back and forth.
That's a revealing word, though, isn't it? I mean, that you would say that.
Well, maybe it was too strong. A vigorous argument would be much better. Yes.
Well, I mean, would he be mean and scathing about when a student was wrong?
No. Just vigorous in his presentation of his point of view.
Mm.
And of course, as a humble graduate student, you can't get too strong with professors, but
yeah.
I think I argued with him as strong as I ever argued with anyone. Mm. I wouldn't ever have dared raise my voice to Alvium, for example. I lived in holy fear of Alvium just because of his great fame, and it wasn't until after I was on the staff for some years that I felt at all at ease with him. But it was a reverence that I felt for him because of the things that he did.
So, well, you say fear and reverence; those are two different feelings.
It was fear first, and later it became reverence, I guess.
He's the hardest personality to get a hold on, from what people say about
yes.
him. That's why I'm trying to find out how you felt about him.
Well, I knew of his abilities because of his discovery of nicotinic acid and the many other nutritionally important pieces of work that he did. But it was he was not a great teacher either. I took an enzyme course from him and it was the dullest thing in the world. He gave us isoelectric points and molecular weights of enzymes when they were known, and almost nothing about the concepts that are important in enzymology. But the person that stands out as the one who I learned biochemistry from was Marvin Johnson. Marvin Johnson was innovative in many different ways. He knew how to do things with tools, with pipe wrenches and soldering irons, and he knew theory. I learned all of my thermodynamics from him. I didn't have him as a professor, as my major professor, but I think I learned more from Marv Johnson than I did from all other professors in the department combined.
Wow. How did you learn from him then? In classes? Or?
Well, we even published a paper together, a humble little paper. In classes, he was very good. Not only did he teach you ideas and concepts, but he knew how to conduct examinations to challenge you. You could take any textbook you wanted to an exam or any assortment of notebooks. I don't think he would have cared what sources of information you used. You couldn't answer the question except by your own imagination, and therefore I think he was a very exceptional teacher. He didn't live up to his abilities as far as research is concerned. He did many tremendously important things in research for the fermentation industry, but I think he could have been a world famous person had he given up fermentation and looked at basic biochemistry of metabolism, which was just developing at that time. He did some classic work on the fermentation of butyrate, and developed a concept concerning the Pasteur effect, which is still a classic and is certainly a basic observation or a basic concept that infiltrates all of metabolic regulation. He was always available, highly eccentric. And I guess.
Can you give an example?
Yes. To give you an example of how he was a genius, but how geniuses respond to some circumstances, he always smoked. And he once came into the laboratory smoking a cigarette, and a student who was working with a beaker of ether panicked and said, don't come here, I'm working with ether. And Marv walked over and took his cigarette out of his mouth and dunked it into the beaker, and of course the cigarette went out without starting a fire. And Marv went on to explain to him how you had to use your head about such things, and he then proceeded to light a match and lit the cigarette, and of course the cigarette was saturated with ether and the whole thing blew up in Marv's face and singed his hair, which is an example of the typical absent-minded professor, I guess. But he was a very delightful person, and always was. I can remember years after he retired, I met him in an airport, I guess it was in Chicago, and riding back to Madison with him. Just in that half hour or so, I got more ideas on research from him than you would have by going to a meeting for 3 weeks. He was just loaded with concepts that were important to approach any experimental problem. So I have great reverence for Marv Johnson's abilities.
I guess it was Van Potter who said who was it? Phillips rode on his back, that is, that he was, who? Maybe not Phillips, who would it be? With whom did he work?
Peterson. Yes.
All right, that Peterson took credit from what Johnson did, and that Johnson.
Yes, Johnson received his degree with Peterson and Fred.
Yes, and
consequently, they recognized the man's ability, and they kept him on first as a senior postdoctorate fellow, which he was when I came, and then later he joined the staff, and he not only directed some of Peterson's students, but also collaborated on a lot of their research, and they published together in some cases. So that I think some of Peterson's fame belongs to Johnson. Mm. During the war, Johnson developed techniques for fermenting for the production of penicillin by the mold. And they were discarding more penicillin down the drain every day than industry was producing, because they were concerned only with increasing the yield. And they did a marvelous job in doing that. And during that time, former students of Marv Johnson were in every industrial laboratory in the country that was producing penicillin. And most of them were directors. In fact, one fellow I remember who had a master's degree with Marv left the lab during the war because of the pressure to get things done, went to Merck, designed an entire factory, supervised its construction, and then put it into operation to grow penicillin during the war. He then came back and got his PhD after the war.
You know, you said years after he retired. I thought he was a younger man.
He retired early because he had some health problems. So I don't know how old he was at the time of his death, but I'm sure he retired before he was 65. Mm.
Because he wasn't on the faculty in the 30s.
No, I came here in 1939, and I think he was a postdoc or some position
That's
like
what
that
I
at that time.
And then came on in 40 or something like
yes.
that. Yes. Mm-hmm. So he was a happy man. He wasn't.
He was always
about
a, oh, he was always a happy man, and well, there are many stories about him. For example, there was some. He was a consultant to a number of companies, and one company called him in once to solve a very serious problem that they had in one of their manufacturing processes. And here was the professor from the University of Wisconsin who went to the shop and got an armful of tools and was up on the roof of the building, and in about an hour or so he had reconstructed something, I don't remember what it was, and that solved the whole problem. And it was something that involved thousands and thousands of dollars of, well, maybe even millions for all I know, of productivity. When I was here as a graduate student, there was a big hassle in Puerto Rico. There was a fermenting facility there that converted molasses into butyl alcohol and ethyl acetate, and a number of solvents were manufactured out of the alcohol and the acetic acid that they produced. And it went awry, and a whole team from Wisconsin, I think Baldwin and Peterson and Elizabeth McCoy and Marv Johnson, all went down to see what they could do about this plant. And within days they found what was wrong, and I think Marv and possibly Elizabeth McCoy stayed on to see that the thing was producing properly, and Peterson and Baldwin came back with a story about how they'd saved this industry down there. And this was, again, the practical side of Wisconsin science.
Yeah,
they were always aware of how science could be applied effectively to industrial problems.
Mm-hmm. How did Johnson get along with Steenbuck and Link and the others?
I think they got along fine. To the best of my knowledge, there never were any conflicts. Personal conflicts. Marvin may have had some ideas as to what was wrong with some of the individuals in the department, but he never voiced them. I never heard him criticize anyone in all my life, but I'm sure he felt that some weren't quite as good scientists as they might have been.
I've gotten the impression that, or not the impression, it's been told to me that the department was divided into empires, and people never crossed boundaries. You never went into Link's lab if you were a Steenbuck student. But from what you say, that it couldn't be entirely true if you
I think anyone could go into Link's laboratory, but you couldn't go into Steenbuck's. I was once taking a course one of Steenbuck's technicians was teaching a laboratory course, and vitamins. And she told me to go upstairs and get a copy of the JBC to find a specific diet that we were using. I was assigned magnesium deficiency. And since she was from Steenbach's laboratory, I assumed she meant I should go up to Steenbach's office and get the JBC. And when I went up, I knocked on the door, and Steenbach greeted me, and I said that the lady had sent me up to get a copy of the JBC, and he exploded and told me that his JBCs were not to be used for any class purpose. I could go to, I guess it was Professor Hart's copy of the JBC would be available to me. He was vicious for minor things like that. Mm. Where do we go from here?
Well, it occurred to me that you know things I don't, so maybe what?
Well, perhaps I should go on then and tell you how I came back to Wisconsin. Would that be of any importance?
Right.
First of all, my impression of the Steenbach-Stahmann controversy. Link-Stahmann controversy. Link had the habit, or the practice, of putting one individual in charge of his laboratory. This was the director of research. Link was sort of chairman of the board, and some senior person was always the director of the laboratories. When I first came, this was Campbell, who you intend to interview. He's over at McArdle now. And it was during that period that dicumarol was isolated and characterized, and Campbell developed these marvelous assays for the effectiveness of dicumarol in decreasing blood clotting by using the diluted serum and so on. Then, sometime, I'm not sure just what year, but it was during the war, I guess, Campbell departed for a position somewhere, and I believe Mark Stahmann was then named the next Gauleiter of the laboratory. He eventually left the lab and went to the Rockefeller Institute to work with Max Bergman. While Mark was the director of the lab, Charlie Huebner isolated dicumarol, and they found it to be identical with a compound that had been described in the literature.
He's another graduate student.
Yes. Charlie was a genius. I understand he has since had a nervous breakdown and is no longer productive, but during his period as a graduate student, he published many papers with Link, solved very complex chemical problems that previous graduate students had brought to a dead end and couldn't solve, and Charlie would pick these problems up and solve them. He published one paper in the JBC with Carl Link when he was still an undergraduate, and I'm sure that it was Charlie who isolated and characterized the dicumarol. Now, after Mark had gone to the Rockefeller, Carl Link suffered another tuberculosis upset. He had been in a sanitarium in Switzerland when he was a postdoctorate fellow in Europe. And when he went to the sanitarium, he needed somebody to direct his laboratory, which was still very productive at that time. And I believe he invited Mark back to do this. The senior person in the laboratory was Dave Doherty, who was a gifted chemist and who did some very interesting work on the resolution of amino acids using enzymes. And some friction developed between Dave and Mark Stahmann. While Mark was running the laboratory, he salvaged the patent on warfarin.
I've read about that. He went to a great deal of effort in corresponding with people.
Yes. Warfarin had been synthesized by Miyoshi Ikawa, and just prior to the year following the publication of its synthesis, Mark succeeded in getting the patent filed for. Scientific information belongs to the public within 1 year after it has been published. And if you want to patent something, you must patent it either before you publish or within a year of its publication date. And Mark succeeded in getting that done. As I understand it, he assigned the patent rights through Worf so that he and Ikawa and Link would share them equally. This resulted in a big upset. An argument between him and Link, most of which was published in the papers. Link decreed that Mark should have none of the royalties, despite the fact that he had gone to the trouble of getting the patents. And he then attempted to get Worf to assign the patents the royalties equally to all of the students that had been in the laboratory at the time, and that didn't work because the three names were on the patent, and Mark's distribution of funds, I think, eventually held.
So you mean he did get some?
Mark?
Yeah.
Oh, yes. Surely. I think he got a third of the royalties. Worf has a practice of giving 15% to the inventors, and mm-hmm. I think Mark and Carl and Miyoshi Ikawa each got 5%, as I heard the story. Now, there may have been other patents. I'm sure there were other patents. I know Link had a patent on a combination of dicumarol and vitamin K and aspirin.
Yes, that's whether another that, story.
Whether that contributed in any significant amount of royalties, I don't know.
It never happened.
Oh, it never. They never succeeded.
Steenbach, as I understand it, prevented that, and that was a cause of their
through
great
Worf.
Yeah.
Yes. Now, concerning the, well, to finish up on that story then, I think that that argument is what resulted in Steenbach and Stahmann never speaking to one another thereafter, and they used to come to
Link
staff.
Link
and Stahmann, pardon me. They used to come to staff meetings and ignore one another. And incidentally, somebody should tell you about Carl Link at staff meetings.
Mm.
Whenever the faculty met and Carl chose to come, which wasn't very often, he brought with him under one arm a large can of Edgeworth tobacco. It looks like about a 3-pound coffee can. His dinner pail, which had in it usually a bottle of beer and a thermos that was full of coffee. And there was a long ritual involved in, immediately after his arrival. The dinner pail would be opened, the coffee cup would come out, it would be poured, he would fill his pipe from the big can of Edgeworth, and it took many matches to eventually get it lit. And this was going on constantly while deliberations of great importance to the department were being discussed. And I think it was mainly for show, because he was flamboyant in every conceivable way. He usually did not participate in the discussions. There were, of course, times when he did express his opinion on a matter, but usually he was a silent member of the faculty. I enjoyed visiting with him always a great deal because I was interested in carbohydrates and interested in a lot of the work that
visiting
had been done in his
when
laboratory.
When you were a graduate
when I was a graduate
in his
student.
Lab.
And also afterward. Mm. He had the best equipment in the department when I came as a student. The work that was done on isolation of the dicumarol from sweet clover required a great deal of elaborate equipment, and he had it and knew how to use it. He was also a good microanalyst, and I used his polarimeter for most of the work that I did from 1945 to 1950 when I left the department.
He was perfectly willing to have you use it.
Oh yes, he was marvelously cooperative to anybody who was civil to him. He was a splendid person, really a marvelous person. I also happened to be the only guy who witnessed the battle between Steenbach and Link in the men's john on the second
heard
floor.
About that, but I, never
I don't know what precipitated the
that was the aspirin
Vitamin K argument.
Yes,
I think.
And I don't know just how, who said what, but I happened to be in the toilet at the time, and Steenbach and Link happened accidentally to come in, or one was in and the other one accidentally came in, and the argument started getting hot and hotter, and I quickly got out of there because I didn't want to be the witness, so I don't know how it came out. It has frequently been said that Link hit Steenbach. No one knows that except
I've
those
heard
two individuals.
Grabbed him around the neck is the statement I've heard from
that,
several people.
That may
but
be,
that
but
be
if so,
powerful.
It had that word had to come from someone who saw it. There was no personal contact at the time I left the men's room.
I think it was Mrs. Steenbach. I wonder if...
Harry may have told her that, yes. Now, concerning the calf scours.
Yes.
Carl was always baiting somebody. He had to have some person that was his scapegoat. For many years, this was Alvium and nutrition, and he would belittle experiments with one rat, which would get a paper in the JVC, and that did happen in some cases. And his...
Excuse me, I don't know what you mean.
Well, a single observation
you
is
mean
never...
Alvium would be doing a paper based on a single observation?
One of Alvium's students named Nielsen found a gray hair factor on the basis of one rat.
Oh, this is the black and white rats.
Yes.
Okay.
And this resulted in a paper in the Journal of Biological Chemistry, which was never substantiated. And Link would refer to that type of research as publication of the morning sputum, to quote him. He was harping on Alvium about nutrition, and then when some controversy arose, I'm not sure what it was, that sort of got him agitated, and he had some ideas on calf nutrition. Calf scours is a very serious problem. It's an infection, and I don't know what he had in mind, but he never would have been hampered from doing anything if he wanted to do it. The dairy department of this university has always been highly cooperative with biochemistry and with other departments. They still are. All I have to do is to call up someone at the barn and say I need so many cc's of cow blood. We went down 2 weeks ago and we're told we could bleed animals to get the blood that we needed for our experiments. I used to feed calves down in that barn on a vitamin A experiment, so I knew the people that were down there. They always collaborated with everyone. And I know that had Link wanted to do experiments with University of Wisconsin calves, all he would have had to do was say the word and it would have happened. Yes?
I think he's had a chance to talk to a few people in the lab. I showed him kind
of... Okay. We're bigger men than that.
Oh.
And I don't think they would have
so
hampered
someone.
So that
would have been a version that Link would have given to the Cap Times reporter, you think?
Possibly, yes.
Mm-hmm.
Well, there are many, many stories about his flamboyance that I'm sure some of his students will tell you.
Yeah.
He was extremely colorful.
I do have many examples of that, but you did say something about he was overrated, I think, at the beginning when you were saying that Steenbach wasn't as great a scholar as a researcher. Didn't you say that Link, also that Link was overrated?
Well, I didn't perceive any great knowledge of chemistry. I think he was a good systematic investigator and helped his students by inspiring them, but I don't, in the classroom, he didn't give the impression of having great insight into carbohydrate chemistry or anything else.
You said that Ikawa did
the synthesis of the dicumarol. Hmm. Yes.
Well, I understand that students, I mean, that the head of the lab has to get the credit for that, but to what extent was it Ikawa's own work?
Well, Ikawa made the compounds, there's no doubt about that. Whether Carl Link told him what types of derivatives to make, or whether he just turned Ikawa loose and said, make some compounds related to dicumarol, I have no idea. There would be other individuals in the laboratory who would know more about that, individuals who were in the laboratory. Mm-hmm. Clint Ballou will be on the campus in August giving one of the talks, and he would certainly know more details about that than I do.
Yeah. Are you actually, Aaron Ide said yesterday, was that biochemistry kept its graduate students for a long time, much longer than most departments, and that they generally weren't given the freedom to choose their own dissertation topics. That is, they didn't set off with a problem and try to solve it. They'd end up by taking some material data that was already there and write it up.
Oh, that's absolutely not true. In my case, apart from the original 3 months of being told how to pursue what problem to pursue, namely the preservation of semen, Phillips never told me anything about what I should do.
You said that Phillips left you free. I'm wondering about the other.
Oh, I think many of the professors let their students be free. Mm. Now, they may have given them an area in which to work and said, I know that Elvium, for example, had money from specific companies to investigate some aspect of dog nutrition. And he worked with dogs a great deal, and I'm sure that the students there were assigned problems, but there was always a great deal of freedom. If a student went off on some sidetrack, and made an observation that was important, Elvium would have been the greatest supporter of the student. He would never have pulled the student back to the original problem if he was doing something creative in another area.
Mm. See, he was a student of Steenbock, so maybe...
Who was that?
I
didn't know he had been
it was a minor. But still, he did spend some time in the department.
Well, Steenbock did rule his students with an iron
hand. So maybe he was generalizing
from
that.
And what resulted was zilch. Very few of Steenbock's students published highly creative, innovative data. Mm. It was feeding so much phytic acid and seeing how much iron there was in the tissues and so on. Now, that was nutritional research at that time, but I would say that Elvium's approach was much more innovative, to search for new vitamins that were required and manipulate diets. And one of the really important concepts that Elvium and his students developed was the finding that tryptophan was the precursor of nicotinic acid, the vitamin he discovered to cure pellagra. Mm-hmm. And that has been very important in many areas, including the areas we're working in now with respect to iron and gluconeogenesis. But I can't agree with Ide concerning the time required. There were some students who finished a PhD in 3 years. Hmm. One of my students finished in 3.5. She was a woman who got out 3 or 4 papers and married while she was still a graduate student, and her husband had a job in Canada, and it was an opportune time for her to leave. She'd done enough, so I asked Elvium whether she could finish early. 4 years, of course, was the traditional minimum. Mm-hmm. And Elvium said, well, Snell had finished in 3 years, and it didn't seem to hurt him, so he thought that my student could also finish in 3.5. Most of us finished in 4, which was standard. I don't know if people in chemistry used less time than that, but...
No, he said 5 years would be like...
Well, there were many duds in Steenbock's laboratory who hung around for 5 or 6 or 7 years.
So he may be generalizing again.
Yes.
From Steenbock's
laboratory. Steenbock had some
laboratory.
Lousy students. He had some good ones, too. But during my period as a graduate student, he had a lot of students that were very marginal. And if you look at those names now, they're not in the people who are publishing any science. In fact, very many of them never did publish any science after they left the lab. Some are in administrative jobs, some are doing Lord knows what. We haven't talked about Frank Strong. He
All
was
right, good.
A good organic chemist who developed an interest in fermentation products. He came from the chemistry department to work with Peterson, and had a good group of what you might call natural products chemists in his among his graduate students, and they developed a great number of compounds that are of useful tools in science. Antimycin, for example, is a useful experimental tool for people investigating tissue metabolism. It's also a practical means of controlling rough fish in lakes and ponds, and he developed some very good students.
So he's one of the top people there, is he?
He never became world famous. He played an important role in the characterization of nicotinic acid as the anti-plegar vitamin.
Yeah, we talked about that.
But I think Frank was always too modest.
He strikes me as very modest.
He's extremely modest. Mm. But he did train some students very effectively, and he had good laboratory approaches so that a student in his laboratory would learn something uh-huh. from him, which I always admired.
So you learned from Phillips, Frank's students, Strong students learned, and Link's did they?
I can't tell you firsthand because I wasn't in Link's laboratory
as
a student.
What's your assessment of Elvium as a researcher?
Well, he was a giant in his day. Van Potter and I submitted a gorgeous nomination for the Nobel Prize for him because of his many contributions. He worked with Hart on the requirement of, or on the discovery that copper is essential mm-hmm. for hemoglobin synthesis. That was a very important discovery. He was the first person to demonstrate, he and his students, that zinc is an essential for animal nutrition. The work he did on nicotinic acid as the cure for pellagra is classic. He had outstanding students in Wayne Woolley working on that, and Frank Strong. And it was obvious that he was an organized, effective director of research.
Well, isn't that different from being a brilliant researcher or a brilliant scientist?
Most brilliant scientists move out of the laboratory to the writing desk sometime or other during their career, and I never saw Elvium doing anything in the laboratory.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Link would make a stab at this. Every now and then, I'm told by his students, he would come out of the office and make gentiobios, which is a molecule of two glucose units hooked up. And no one ever knew why he was making this, according to his students. But every now and then he'd get the urge to be in the lab and make something, and that's what he would make.
I'm just trying to, a judgment was made of Elvium that he was methodical and that it was not really a great scientist. That's what I'm trying, and you would disagree with that.
Oh, I think you'd have to say he was a great scientist, mm-hmm. yes. Great science is relative because within 5 years of a discovery, unless it's a gigantic discovery or really fundamental discovery, it's more or less absorbed into the literature and people don't pay much attention to it. No one ever mentions now, for example, that he discovered the cure for pellagra, despite the fact that there were hundreds of thousands of people mm-hmm. suffering from that disease when he found nicotinic acid to be the effective agent. But I think he was what you would call a very good scientist.
Mm-hmm. Well, maybe